Hi, I'm Rana Sarkar, and you're listening to Confluence. In each episode, we dive deep into the issues shaping tech, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lenses of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. This week, my guest is James Crabtree. And for the purposes of this interview, his most important title is Executive Director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. If you're a regular reader of the Financial Times and follow the geopolitics and cultural shifts of Asia, you'll recognize James's sharp-eyed commentary. He's been based on the lovely island of Singapore for the better part of a decade, where he's also a professor of practice at Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy. Prior to that, James was based in Mumbai as the Financial Times bureau chief. And from that experience, he wrote an award-winning book, The Billionaire Raj. For decades now, James has been writing, providing analysis for top publications, think tanks, and governments, and has even had a deep dark past as an advisor to No. 10 Downing Street's strategy unit. I've had the pleasure of knowing James for decades now, and find his wide-ranging and often witty takes extremely compelling. We reach him at a key moment, where he's about to host the leaders of Asia at the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore. Arguably, this conference is of heightened importance, given the geopolitical and geoeconomic tensions, and the new institutions and major shifts in the Indo-Pacific region, which have global implications. Spoiler alert, tech is at the center of it.
Let me just dive into it. Can you tell us a little bit about the Shangri-La Dialogue, what you're expecting, and what is it, and what's at stake?
So the Shangri-La Dialogue is run by the organization I work for, the IISS, the International Institute for Strategic Studies. It's the biggest defense security gathering in Asia each year. If you walk into the lobby of the Shangri-La Hotel in Singapore on June the 10th, then you will find all of the region's defense ministers, the heads of the military, the heads of defense departments, lots of people dressed in green and white uniforms. And they come to Singapore both to give speeches about the state of the region, but also to talk to one another privately and on background. Typically, it's one of the few places in the region where the United States Defense Secretary and his Chinese counterpart will be in the same room as one another. So a major theme of the dialogue is the ongoing great power competition between the US and China. It's also interesting because this is the first time that we've been able to run it in a couple of years. So the last two iterations were canceled because of COVID. So it's been 2019 was the last one. So in a sense, we're seeing across Asia the return of in-person diplomacy. We're an example of that, but you also have the G20 summit later in the year, a whole rash of different summits, including, just as we're speaking, the Quad summit, which happened around the time that this podcast was recorded in Tokyo, where President Biden and the other three regional leaders came to meet in person in Tokyo. So I think it's an exciting time to be looking at Asian geopolitics, geoeconomics, and technology, in part because these gatherings of power brokers, of chief executives, of ministers, of world leaders are happening again. And so we're playing our small part in that with the Shangri-La Dialogue.
We've had, over the last several months, we've had sort of almost a plethora of new gatherings that are taking place. We've had the Quad, as you've mentioned. What's driving all of these new arrangements? And can you give us a sense of what you see the architecture of these new associations in the next 6 months or a year is shaping up to?
So what you see in Asia is quite different from what you see in Europe. So against the backdrop of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, you've seen a reemergence of the world's most important military alliance, namely NATO, of which Canada is a member, which brings together a couple of dozen countries or more with two new members now in a self-defense pact. And that has been reinvigorated in various respects by Putin's invasion. In Asia, things look very different. You don't have a single alliance structure on either side. What you have is a kind of mishmash in which the US has some traditional alliances with countries like Japan, Australia, and the Republic of Korea. China has some countries it's very close to, like North Korea in particular. But what you really see in the region is an emergence of a new rash of what we at the IISS call minilateral groupings. The Quad would be one, the four countries who are China skeptics. AUKUS would be another, the Anglosphere gathering that's initially designed to give Australia some nuclear submarines. But there's a whole rash of these things. China has the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. There's the BRICS. And so it's a facet of diplomacy that, as competition between not just the great powers, but also countries like India, Japan, the European countries has competed, then there has been a rash of new architecture, is the word that you called, as countries come together to try and solve problems in the international system. Some of these are, in a sense, doing positive things like providing public goods, vaccines for COVID and that kind of thing. Some of them are more security focused, as in attempting to gather together coalitions in various respects who can balance China militarily or set new rules of the road for technological standards, whatever it might be. So I think the rise of minilateralism is one of the most important security trends that you see in Asia at the moment.
We're talking about the Indo-Pacific these days, and we're not talking about the Asia-Pacific. Why are we talking about the Indo-Pacific?
Well, in a funny sense, the IISS does tend to still talk about the Asia-Pacific, and there's, you know, you still do get some people doing this. The British military rather awkwardly talk about the Indo-Asia-Pacifics. So most people now talk about the Indo-Pacific as the phrase. It was originated by Japan, adopted by America, and now in one form or another is used as the term by many countries in the region. China doesn't like it. It sees it as a basically anti-Chinese construct. I mean, the idea from Japan and then the United States was to broaden our conception of the Indo-Pacific to include India, very simply, because India is a China-skeptic nation. And so if you conceive of Asia as a space which stretches from the United States to India, then within that space, you have more countries who are worried about China. If you look at Asia more narrowly as the region around China's periphery, then that looks more favorable to China. So it was a sort of cartographic exercise in power projection that was originally thought up by Prime Minister Abe, that was then adopted somewhat on a whim by President Trump when he needed something to talk about, and now has become the standard. But what people mean by the Indo-Pacific, particularly what people mean by the free and open Indo-Pacific, is still pretty contested. What ASEAN countries in Southeast Asia mean by that term is quite different from what India or Australia mean.
James, how do you see the China-US conflict, particularly in the context of the post-invasion of Ukraine by Russia? How is that shaping up, and how is that changing the architecture or accelerating it, as it were?
Well, the position is not good. Relations between the US and China are bad. They could be worse. They have been on a downward trajectory over recent years. They were bad in a kind of pugilistic and choppy way during the Trump years, when Trump would whack China on the nose with tariffs or go after Huawei. They're bad in a slightly more stable and sullen way under Biden, in which the relationship is a bit more predictable. It doesn't have that kind of chaotic spirit to it that was true in the Trump years, but you know, it's not good. And there isn't much prospect of it improving. The two sides aren't really talking to one another, which is a bad sign. If you think about a marriage, if they're shunning one another and not talking, then the chances of improvement are low. So Biden and Xi haven't met one another. They have spoken a couple of times over video link, but their advisors don't talk to each other very much. And in a sense, this relationship has been sort of further solidified during Ukraine. Early on in the Ukraine conflict, the Americans did reach out to the Chinese to see if it might be possible to get them to say very broadly, you know, we don't believe in interference in other people's internal affairs, and therefore, you know, it's not a great thing that you're invading another sovereign country. China didn't want to say that. The reason they didn't want to say that, I think, is because ultimately, although they didn't much like what the Russians had done and they didn't support it privately, they didn't feel that they could turn against Russia, who are their close partner, and in a sense hand a diplomatic victory to the Americans, who are their peer adversary. And so I looked at this through the prism of great power competition and decided basically we've got to stick with the Russians. And that's sort of what you see continuing. So Ukraine has, in a sense, solidified the position of China and the US as leaders of opposing blocs, a kind of roughly democratically leaning bloc on the one hand and an autocratic bloc on the other, of which China and Russia are the two poles. You saw on February 4th, the Chinese and Russian governments released this very unusual 5,000-word manifesto for cooperation that talked about partnership without limits. And while that partnership has been somewhat degraded by the diminution of Russia's position over Ukraine, you know, its military is clearly less capable than it was before, its diplomatic position is pretty terrible. You know, nonetheless, it's clear that both sides want to put some stead in that cooperation. And only a day before the moment when this podcast is being recorded, you saw that when China and Russia flew a joint sortie of nuclear-capable bombers over waters near Japan in retaliation for Biden's arrival in the Quad Summit. So you see China and Russia beginning to do things together. I would say relations between the US and China are not great, and there are certainly risks on the downside.
So We're also seeing it as well, I guess, with the creation of China now feeling compelled to create things like the Global Security Forum. And of course, the U.S. this week in Asia with the U.S. president in Asia, and of course, the announcement of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework as a link there. But you speak quite pessimistically about both those two frameworks. In one of your articles recently, you suggest that both of them leave for a bit of wanting. Can you describe why you think both those approaches might not work?
It's an interesting moment in the tussle between the two superpowers. And the positive thing to say is that, you know, they're learning and adapting as they begin to kind of tussle with one another. They're trying to figure out what each other's weaknesses are and how they can also patch up their own weaknesses. And so both of these initiatives are an attempt to patch up each other's weaknesses. So Biden recognizes that America doesn't have a very good economic partnership story, in part because the US has gone off doing proper trade deals. So they've come up with this thing called the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which they launched at the Quad meeting in Japan. The launch was reasonably successful, I would say, albeit with low expectations. They did manage to kind of finally cajole a dozen countries to sign up to the thing, albeit all they're signing up to is to have preparatory negotiations to discuss a potential agreement as opposed to actually signing up to anything meaningful. In the end, the problem with IPEF, as it's called, is it doesn't really offer any particular economic benefits to its members. So the US makes demands of people. It says, we'd like you to have high labor standards or do more for the environment or set up potentially awkward new systems of regulating digital commerce. But if you do that, we're not going to lower tariffs or give you any particular economic benefits. On the Chinese side, they've talked about recently over the last month in a number of speeches, beginning with a speech that Xi made at a forum in China, where they talked about a new global security initiative, which is a bit, details are a bit sketchy at the moment. That's often the way with these Chinese initiatives. It was true with the Belt and Road Initiative when it started, that it was just a speech and people scratched their head and thought, will this thing ever amount to anything? And then over the next 5 years, the Chinese spent $1 trillion on infrastructure. So one should take it seriously when Xi stands up at a conference and says, we're going to roll out a new piece of global security architecture. It's not entirely clear what it is going to amount to. However, it is clear that what the Chinese are trying to do is they've identified a weakness, which is that the US has a great US-led security architecture. You can just see that over Ukraine, its ability to convene its allies, to take action internationally, to punish Russia. It was very impressive. I mean, it happened with great speed. And in a sense, in many ways, the US has emerged as a strengthened power after Ukraine. It has demonstrated its convening power. It's shown technological leadership. It's clearly got fantastic use of intelligence. It was able to work with the Europeans. It turned Russia from a, you know, sort of advanced middle-income country into a sort of pariah overnight. China doesn't have that capability, and it would like to have that capability, in particular by focusing on building greater ties of various sorts with the emerging world. So if you sort of sum that up, the paradoxical thing about it is that the US is launching an economic plan which doesn't offer much in the way of economic benefits, and China is offering a security plan. But the problem for China is it acts in such a way that it makes all of its neighbors feel less secure all the time, because China's style of international diplomacy is very quid pro quo. It's very vindictive, would be too harsh, but it imposes costs on people who disagree with it. And it has a well-noted position that smaller countries should, in a sense, do what China wants to do, because China is a big country. So if you're a Southeast Asian country, you won't say this publicly because we don't want to offend the Chinese, but all of the Southeast Asian countries are very intimidated by China. They feel very insecure. They worry about what China thinks about things. And so if China is trying to develop a security partnership which is going to help its neighbors and friends feel more secure, then it's going about it in a rather funny way. And so I think that just tells you that the two superpowers are, you know, to some degree, flawed entities. If you were to take your platonic ideal of a perfect superpower, you know, America in 1995, that is both economic and militarily dominant and seemingly very competent, well, neither America or China really match up to that model. They are both, in various different respects, flawed superpowers. And so all of the countries in the region, and indeed globally, are trying to work out how to navigate around the way the superpowers are acting.
What do you think that we're missing when we speak about the geopolitics of this region? Are we not focusing on enough about critical supply chain issues in chips, for instance? Are we not focusing in on the quantum race that's taking place behind the scenes? Are we missing sort of competition or potentially co-optation in artificial intelligence? What would you suggest that people pay more attention to?
The lesson of Ukraine is pretty clear here, which is that it's very hard for people to focus in on an extreme geopolitical event, a military event, you know, an invasion or something of that sort. We saw this coming, and lots of people looked at it and said, well, we don't think it's going to happen. It's not rational. Putin wouldn't do this. You know, he's just saber rattling. And so even with an awful lot of warning, most people were suddenly taken by surprise when the tanks rolled over the borders. It's not something that we've seen in generations, that you have a land war in Europe with armor heading into a neighboring country. And the same is true with China. I mean, all of the stuff that you mentioned is absolutely fine. You know, one could focus more on supply chains and Chinese economic policy and rare earths and renewables, but really the black swan here is what happens if there's a war in Asia, particularly between the superpowers, or indeed whether there's a war between the US and Russia over Ukraine, which is, I think, now perfectly plausible, or a war between China and India. And so the likelihood of interstate conflict is rising. And as you saw with Russia, Ukraine, when that happens, the effect on business and by extension technology is extremely dramatic. You know, Russia has been ejected in a sense from the world technological system. The US and its allies also took a number of steps in prosecuting that war, which have had, I don't want to say sort of earthquakes, but have had shockwaves that have reverberated around the global system in terms of access to technology, also the weaponization of financial systems, which is, that has been noticed far and wide, that the US was willing to take supposedly neutral architectural platforms like SWIFT and weaponize them in the event of conflict. And so what do you do about this? I mean, if somebody explained it to me this way, it's a bit like you're living, since you're in San Francisco, it's a bit like you're living in San Francisco in 1906, and somebody's telling you, well, there could be an earthquake. So you have a question, which is the risk of the earthquake so bad that you leave the city? Maybe. In some cases, that's what companies are now beginning to do. They're moving out of China because of this risk. If you're not willing to leave the city, then certainly you want to be looking at the foundations of your buildings and putting in earthquake-resistant architecture in your house. And so, well, what does that mean? That's what companies are doing. They're developing separate supply chains which touch China much less. They're trying to extricate themselves from the Chinese system. They're very worried about semiconductors, given were there to be a conflict between the US and China, then the most likely causes is Taiwan, which is the global center for semiconductor manufacturing. That's the dilemma. That's what it's very hard for people to focus on this, because the chances of it are, you know, hopefully low but rising, but the consequences of are severe and extremely complex and sort of interactive, if you see what I mean. I don't think it would have been easy to puzzle out in advance what would have happened after a scenario involving the Soviet invasion of Ukraine, but a whole lot of things suddenly happened in a big hurry. Order effects will be, and how a business should respond, thinking about their supply chains, their brand, their position, their foothold in the Chinese market, no less. You know, that is very complicated. And so I think that's really what people are grappling with at the moment, but it's hard to do.
How do you see Western companies, and particularly Western tech companies, how do you see their posture is evolving over the next year or two?
It's complicated, right? Because different companies have a different position vis-a-vis China. So the social media giants aren't really in China in a meaningful sense. A company like Tesla is going into China, you know, great guns, because it wants to manufacture in China and it wants to sell a whole bunch of cars in China. Cloud companies, limited in the Chinese market. In fact, any companies that need to transfer data through the kind of Western system and the Chinese system, this is now very problematic. I mean, that was what the whole fiasco over TikTok was about, but it's a much wider sense. Then if you're talking about manufacturing, and that's not just tech companies, I mean, car companies need semiconductors, electronic vehicles need semiconductors, everyone needs semiconductors. And so that's a sort of different set of anxieties. So I think it depends on, you know, which segment you're in and why. Certainly it's not the case that everyone is moving out of China. I mean, I had a conversation the other day with somebody who ran a division of a large computer manufacturer. They said that they were basically on a journey to extricating themselves from China. Said it had taken them 10 years to set up all their Chinese supply chains, and you know, God willing, it would take them another 10 years to get out, but that was kind of where they were going. But it just took a long time because China is by far the best place in the world to make computers. And if you decide that what you want to do is sort of keep your Chinese subsidiary that will sell to the Chinese market, but basically get as much of the rest of it out as you can and distribute it over India, Vietnam, Mexico, Poland, then that's much more complicated. It's part of the reason, not the biggest reason anymore, but at least part of the reason why we have a global spike in inflation at the moment is you're beginning to see this shift of supply chains in which people, you know, it's either China plus one or something more severe than that. On the other hand, if you're a financial institution, the financial institutions, the sort of big Wall Street banks and American insurers are still happily investing more in China. And so they have taken a judgment call that they think it's sort of worth the risk, and that the sort of Chinese market, they've been trying to get into it for ages and ages and ages. China has actually been opening up a bit to Western financial institutions of late, and there are still sort of elements of openness that are happening in China, even as all of this is going on. So I think it's complicated and a bit messy, but I think it would be fair to say that corporate leaders across the West have not grappled appropriately with the downside risks of, you know, what is now staring us in the face, that the possibility of, you know, proper conflict between the US and China is very conceivable. I mean, even a year ago, people didn't often talk about a war between the US and China. It's much more common now. So the language that you would have heard only in the US military as they were running through scenarios is now much more common. And that's depressing, but at least it shows that people are beginning to kind of grapple with the way that the world is moving. And only when you do that, do you begin to think about how it might be avoided.
What would you see for, particularly in the tech domain, like what do you see is the biggest risk that this new division between China and the United States, what is that biggest risk?
I mean, I suppose one way you could think about it is over the last two decades, the kind of high years of globalization, people tend to think about this in terms of financial flows or trade in, if we think about our images of globalization, it's container ships and containers themselves and cranes outside of Shanghai. But we've also had a very unusual period of global technological openness in which, you know, the universities of Stanford and Berkeley, near where you're sitting, Rana, are packed with Chinese PhDs. And vice versa, you know, we've had to some reasonable degree, a lot of flows of ideas and techniques into China. A lot of that is ending. I mean, it's clear that it's much less easy for Americans to tap Chinese talent now. There's a lot of suspicion and worries about national security. The walls in many respects have gone up against American companies in the Chinese system. Not only that, but also to some degree in big countries like India as well, which is a more ambiguous case. And so I think that open ecosystem of technological innovation that has delivered a lot of benefit for the world is now, walls are going up in the middle of it. And it might be a case that in some ways, I don't know if this is true in Canada, but there's an English phrase, good fences make good neighbors, as in there were elements of the free-flowing global system that created tensions, too many people crossing borders, too much destabilizing international capital kind of swilling around, creating a nuisance of itself. And so there may be some positive upsides of a world that has slightly higher barriers, but I think there's a lot of downsides too.
From here, our conversation shifts to climate change, which is also having an enormous impact on our current geopolitical moment.
How do you see the politics of climate and the new economics of climate fitting into the challenges of Indo-Pacific geopolitics right now?
I think it's very alarming. I mean, I don't want to come across as too much of a sort of bad news bear in this conversation, but the challenge of climate is enormous. I think we all agree with this. It's a hell of a problem simply because of the coordination challenge between nations and the practical and to some degree ethical question of whose fault is it and who should pay to tidy it up. So you have that question and you have the problem of who should do it, who can do it. Coordinating those problems was really difficult in an era in which the international system worked reasonably well under American, I mean, hegemony, they'd call it in me amongst my IR friends. You know, when America was top dog, they sort of ran the system and want to have people have different views on how benignly they ran the system, but system sort of broadly worked. You had bodies like the G20 that could kind of get things done with. That all is breaking down now. I mean, while we talked earlier in the podcast about the rise of minilateralism, traditional multilateralism has been badly damaged by great power competition. You saw this in the COVID pandemic, where it was very, very difficult for the US and China to cooperate on anything to do with vaccines, to do with COVID relief. In fact, they tended to compete with one another. And the end result was an international response to the COVID crisis that was technically ineffective and to some degree morally bankrupt, because it meant that vaccines were not given in anything like the numbers that they needed to developing countries. And you've just seen that continue. The G20 at the moment, which is in theory the coordinating body most appropriate to solving large global problems like climate. I mean, the G20 members are the critical parts of the climate solution, is dysfunctional at the moment. I mean, it can barely produce a communique. And that will get even worse in the G20 in Indonesia, when the poor old Indonesians have to cope with the fact that they must invite Putin and Zelensky and Biden and Xi to sit in one room and try and get them to do something productive. I mean, it's an almost impossible task, one rather feels for Jokowi. I mean, I think there are some signs of optimism. The COP in Glasgow, actually, through the work of John Kerry and his opposite number, did produce some reasonably robust progress. You also saw India beginning to kind of step up to the plate. And you do begin to see, you know, events in the world focus in on climate. You've seen extreme weather in India recently. But unfortunately, I feel like there's a pattern on climate, which is that the response always lags the severity of the problem. Some of your readers may have read an excellent recent novel by Kim Stanley Robinson called The Ministry for the Future, which if they haven't read, I would heartily recommend. It's an extremely bleak, but very imaginative and interesting, they call it cli-fi for climate fiction, which gives a vision of how the geopolitics of climate might develop over the next couple of decades. It's very sobering in terms of the world that we're heading into, but it also gives you a sense of the kind of contours of the sort of political failure around climate change and where it might lead you to. So if anyone is minded, I would very much recommend The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. I felt like I took a lot out of that. So
we then wrapped up our conversation focusing on how Canada might fit into the new geopolitical architecture being developed.
Fits into a reasonably long list of countries outside of the core Indo-Pacific that are trying to do more in the region. So Canada styles itself as an Indo-Pacific nation, given it has a coast on the Pacific, but it's still quite far away and it's a mid-sized country. And so along with countries like Britain and France and Germany, for instance, they're producing Indo-Pacific documents of the one that Canada is about to produce, which is good. I think the curious thing for Canada is it's been through this before under the Harper government. Harper was very, very keen on engagement with this region and did a lot of work on trying to kind of build ties. And it slightly then dissipated. That's partly a structural issue, which is one of the big things that Canada offers this region is energy, but for reasons of climate, Canada no longer wants to style itself as a sort of energy superpower. It wants to build links in different ways. And so now I think we're entering kind of Canada in the Indo-Pacific 2.0 with a new foreign minister, a new defense minister, and a re-elected Justin Trudeau. And I think the region is very open to countries like Canada playing, or Britain or Germany or France coming and playing more of a role. And the question is always, okay, so what have you got? What have you got to offer? And so there, people are open to new forms of partnership from advanced, technologically leading countries in the G7 and the G20. And I think there'll be some interest to see how Canada frames this, what the kind of the pointy end of its offer is in terms of partnership, but crucially how it is sustained. Because the lesson of the Harper years was a country that came and talked a lot about the Indo-Pacific and then sort of stopped talking about the Indo-Pacific and decided to talk about other things. And so that, I think, is what people will be looking for from Canada and other nations is, so you're going to say you're going to do more, then show us what you want to do and let's see how long you're willing to do it and what resources you're willing to put into it.
You've been extraordinarily generous with your time, James, and it's always a great pleasure.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Confluence. I hope you were able to walk away from today's episode with some new perspectives. Some additional resources are available in the episode show notes. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edita Audio. Special thanks to James Crabtree for being my guest. Production thanks to Marie Olnick, Kate Walter, Augustus Clark, Steph Colburn, Kathleen Speckert, and Kanika Codrington. I'm Rana Sarkar, and thank you for listening. Until next time.